Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I want to welcome our guest co-host today, Dr. Jamila Battle. On our show today, Jamila, we're going to hear a recent conversation that I had with Dr. Stephen Hooper with Dr. Rachel Hertz, a neuroscientist at Brown University and Boston College, about a new book she wrote, Why You Eat What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. A really interesting and important conversation, don't you think?
It's definitely important.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have that conversation. First, we got some interesting research that matters. Let's look at our very first one. And this is about emotional suppression of feelings between couples and the outcomes of this on children. You know, do you just like say, let's not talk about it in front of the child?
I've done both. I've said, let's not talk about it, and I've suppressed it. And sometimes I'm like, you know what? Oh, I'm going to let the kid know I had a rough day.
Well, this is research that was actually done and published in the journal Emotion, and it was looked at 109 mothers or fathers, mostly mothers. They had a hard time getting fathers for the study in San Francisco, and they wanted to see if differences resulted between genders and when these parents were either given a stressful task or when parents and children were given tasks in different ways of understanding them, like building a Lego with no instructions.
And they wanted to see if the parent had a stressful task, such as public speaking with negative feedback provided by the audience, and then was later put together with kids to do this task without instructions so that it kind of forces them to engage and work closely, what would the responsiveness or the interaction look like if the parents were suppressing their emotions or not?
And what they basically said is that In looking at these videotapes and then watching them, is that trying to suppress the stress made the parents less positive when they were actually working with their children. So if you came into that area and you were stressed and you didn't kind of acknowledge that you're stressed, you were really probably kind of preoccupied a little bit and you were perhaps less able to be there. And it made and it affected the children. They were kind of more sensitive to their mothers, didn't have as much impact with the fathers. A lot going on here. I'm really having a hard time really trying to figure out fully what to take from it, other than the fact that perhaps it's okay to certainly say, I'm feeling stressed.
It certainly shows to the child even that, you know what, there's healthy conflicts, and seeing that from start to resolution, from start to finish, and demonstrating to the child that, you know, there's a way to regulate our own emotions and solve problems, I think can help them with emotional resiliency.
And it seems though the question would be how one does that, right? It's okay to say, I'm feeling stressed. It's probably not okay to say, I'm feeling stressed, even though that's what you might want to say, right?
Exactly.
Particularly to a young child.
Yeah. Well, they pick up on that.
Yeah. So. Always says, say your emotions, don't show your emotions. I don't know if that's right, but we'll see. And let's talk about our next research that matters. And this kind of goes from the stress of young children to the stress of children playing football. I think there's increasingly a lot of parents out there that are really worried about their children playing football because they recognize over long periods of time the repeated trauma to the head in particular can cause significant long-term brain damage. We see this in the NFL players. So the question is in younger players. And what about for players who don't have these concussions?
Well, it sounds like they saw more gray matter volume in those who had high impact hits. And the gray matter indicates in the brain that what they postulate is, it's not, maybe the brain is not working as well as it could be, and that there is a pruning process that takes place between the neuronal connections in our brain that are constantly changing. And it's similar to trimming a tree. And if you prune away dead branches, then it grows healthy. So this also occurs in the brain. And they found, 60 youth high school football players aged 9-18 that didn't have a concussion or didn't have developmental neurological psychiatric disorders, that there was more volume, gray matter volume, that could maybe lead to less efficiency because there wasn't pruning occurring.
Right. And these kids had had hits, but not the concussions. And, you know, these are just, you know, after a season of football, you know, maybe it regenerates, maybe it comes back, maybe that pruning. But, you know, to me, I don't like people cutting out my my neurons of my brain. I was like, yeah, really? Pruning the tree versus pruning the neurons of the brain? I don't know. But this is, again, you know, we're getting more pieces here. We're getting more pieces of a jigsaw puzzle to begin to understand. And I do think it is cause for concern. You know, it is just one season of football. It's preliminary research, but it shows that repetitive impact, repetitive hits, short of concussions, you can see changes in the brain. If I'm a parent and I'm a doctor advising parents, I'm saying, look at this research before you make decisions.
That's right. I thought it was also interesting that there is another area of the brain called the default mode network, and that even this area was impacted. And that's the area that is responsible for planning and controlling social behaviors. So
I think flag football is much better. I mean, I see these football players, even the ones that aren't, you know, being tagged at, you know, it's really rough.
Yeah.
Let's talk about something that's maybe less rough, but probably just as important. And that's how lack of sleep, something that you study all the time, how that impacts emotional regulation, in this case, anger.
Well, it's well established that sleep loss increases negative emotions such as anxiety and sadness, and decreases positive emotions such as happiness and enthusiasm. This was published in the Journal of Experimental Psychology at Iowa State University. And what did they find?
Well, they found that if you reduce the sleep of this group to artificially make them have less sleep, and then you expose them the next day to things that are irritating. In this case, it was like noise, like spraying water, or kind of, you know, just noise. Like for myself, I don't really like noises that aren't supposed to be there, like a barking dog. But if you gave me less sleep and you made me hear these kind of noises, I was much more angry. And then it also has other impacts, and they did this work with college students who were also with less sleep, and they had more anger than when they got more sleep. This is, makes such good sense,
it
but
does.
It's so important because we, you know, you don't just wake up the next day and say, oh, I'm just not going to be angry today. You don't have that control necessarily, and you may not know that you're being more angry as that day wears on.
That's correct. And it's also interesting to point out that they saw a subjective sleepiness with more intense feelings of anger, and that they're also collecting data to see if the sleep loss causes aggressive behavior as well.
Yeah, I think this is important research. I think it's worth really noting for all of us at all ages that the lack of sleep cumulatively is really bad on so many health outcomes. And this is one that's so fundamental, getting angry that following day or maybe that following night and not recognizing that the choices we made that previous evening could have impacted it.
That's right.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We're going to take a short break. And when we return, we're going to hear about a recent conversation we had with neuroscientist Dr. Rachel Hertz of Brown University and Boston College about a new book, an important new book called Why You Eat What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamelia Battle. Stay with us. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Steve Hooper. Today on Conversation, Steve, we're talking with neuroscientist Dr. Rachel Hertz of Brown University and Boston College about her new book, Why You Eat What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Hertz.
Thank you very much, Adam and Steve.
You know, it's great to have you here. And I must say that your book promises so much, and I'm so excited to have you as a guest. But first off, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get to where you're at?
Well, my research background for the last almost 30 years has been in the sense of smell and taste and flavor. Those are the senses that most people typically think of when they think about eating. So I have the research background from the sensory perspective sort of fairly well laid out, but there's also, it turns out, a lot to do with what we see and what we hear and even what we feel when it comes to eating. My research, though, is also involved in motivated behavior and emotion and memory, and so that gets into the more psychological and emotional sides of eating and food. And it turns out that I've written two books prior to this one. The first is about the psychology of the sense of smell. It's called The Scent of Desire. It's everything you ever wanted to know about your wonderful nose. And the second book is called That's Disgusting, and it's all about the emotion of disgust, which is, in fact, a taste-based emotion. We feel disgusted emotionally at things that underlie our rejection of poison and contamination, and rejection of bitter taste in particular is where the emotion of disgust is actually scaffolded onto. And so thirdly is that I love food and I love eating. And so it seemed to make sense that my next book after the smell book and the disgust book would actually tap into combining it all together in a very pleasant project, that being about food and eating. So that's how I got to where I am.
So one of the interesting things is that your work has taken you into a field called neurogastronomy. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is a new field. It's the term neurogastronomy was coined about 10 years ago in a Nature paper by Gordon Shepherd, who is a neuropsychologist at Yale University, and he specializes in the sense of smell as well and the perception of flavor. And the topic of neurogastronomy is to bring together sensory science, neuroscience, social behavior, and the culture of eating into one discipline, and understanding all the nuances and factors that influence our relationship with food, which come from the outside in. And so what this book is about is really neurogastronomy, but rather than fluffing it up with that name, the idea of just taking it down to the more practical aspects of the how the sensory and the psychological and the environmental and social and emotional aspects of our lives all influence how we perceive food, how we eat food, and even the consequences of what eating that food does to us.
You know, I was really interested a couple years ago in my own research looking at the way people perceive taste. And of course, I thought flavor, and I was doing research on flavors in tobacco products and how people really perceive these things. And someone said, here, read this book. And it was all about smell. And I was like, no, wait a second. I'm interested in taste, not smell. This is not a surprise to you. Tell us and our listeners the relationship between taste and smell.
Okay, well, taste is actually a very simple sensory system. In the strictest sense, we only perceive four basic tastes, those being salt, sour, sweet, and bitter. There's a few other sensations that can be in the mix, although they're not canonical basic tastes. That's umami, fat perception, and the burn of hot peppers. But in any event, it's a very simple sensory system. And everything else that we experience when it comes to food comes through our nose, because when we're eating, we're also breathing. And the inhalation of air that comes in from taking a bite of something enables the aromatic molecules that are in that food while we're chewing to then go up through an opening at the back of the mouth into the nose and land on those exact same olfactory sensory neurons and the receptors there as when we sniff and we're sniffing a rose, let's say, from the outside. And the exhalation lets that air pass over and we get the perception of the aroma from what is going on in our mouth. So, for example, the experience of eating bacon is the taste of salt and the aroma of bacon, and they combine together as one sensation in the mouth, and it seems as if it's coming from the mouth, but really it's coming from the nose. And so there's this kind of localization illusion. We think it's coming from our mouth, but it's really in our nose, and our sense of smell is giving us all the fabulousness of what we're eating, and really not so much taste, except for when we love the taste of sweet, which we do innately, and also the taste of salt, which is pretty positive to most people.
So one of the other questions related to that is, what happens when that sense of smell begins to change or deteriorate, or perhaps, given the what we know about the location of those olfactory bulbs in the frontal regions of our brain, what happens when they get damaged?
Right. So in The Scent of Desire, actually my first book was triggered by being an expert witness for the very first time for a woman who lost her sense of smell in a traumatic car accident, and everything about her life was upended in a really, really disturbing and debilitating way. And it turns out that when you lose your sense of smell, all kinds of aspects of our quality of life deteriorates. Now, most people don't have the misfortune of having an accident which destroys their sense of smell. But all of us, if we're lucky enough, get old. And just like our other senses, hearing and vision, our sense of smell starts to falter. And what happens actually is our olfactory sensory neurons are directly exposed in our nose to the outside. There's no protective barrier. Unlike, for example, with vision, we have the cornea protecting our retina and the neurons of the eye from the outside. And in hearing, we have the tympanum, you know, protecting our inner ear and so on. With olfaction, those neurons are really hanging out there at the top of our nose. And as a function of the fact that they're exposed to all kinds of, you know, pollution and all kinds of other things, they're actually turning over constantly. So we're, in fact, getting a new nose about every 28 days. But what happens is that as we age, that turnover starts failing somewhat, so that the neurons that have been damaged by the environment are no longer available, and the regeneration starts slowing down, so that we're not getting the full complement of regeneration as we once were, although there's a lot of individual variation. But it is estimated that over the age of about 80 or 85, about 50% of the population has become effectively anosmic, that is to say, smell blind, although they don't realize it because it's been a very gradual loss. But it can have serious consequences, especially when it comes to nutritional health, because what happens is that people who can't smell don't get the pleasure that they would have had from food, but they also don't get the cues to eat that they might have otherwise, so being able to smell food and being reminded to eat. So if somebody's living alone and they're elderly and they're not eating properly and they don't have a functioning sense of smell, they can, in fact, as a function of malnutrition, start developing cognitive problems, which are all to do with the fact that they're not getting adequate food and not to do with real dementia. And it has been discovered that in some of these cases, just recognizing what the underlying problem is, that is not having a functioning sense of smell, and then getting back on a proper diet can completely reverse these symptoms, which might have been mistaken for dementia. So it's really important to be aware of whether or not you can actually smell, especially if you live alone and are older, and make sure that you are getting adequate nutrition in your diet.
So let me ask a question as we're starting to now get into your book. When we're talking with Dr. Rachel Hertz, author of the new book, Why You Eat What You Eat, what made you write this book? What was the underlying reason you said and you kind of hope that people will really get?
So the reason I wrote this book is, I mean, we live in a world where food is accessible all the time. And we're also dealing with an obesity epidemic and a diabetes epidemic and a variety of health problems, on top of which people often feel really tortured in their relationship with food, and this kind of whole pleasure-displeasure conundrum. And what I'm hoping from reading my book is that people become aware and begin to understand all the influences that are affecting them with respect to how they perceive food, so that they can then feel that they're in charge of their experience of food and eating, rather than feeling that food is controlling them, and in so doing, create a happier and healthier relationship with food. I don't want anyone to restrict themselves. I want you to eat the donut if you want the donut, but I want to make sure that you're experiencing the pleasure in that's worth the calories or the nutritional consequences of that as a function of what you're doing.
I am delighted to hear I can eat that donut when I want to eat it. And
Only one.
Thank you, Adam. We need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with neuroscientist Dr. Rachel Hertz of Brown University and Boston College about her book, Why You Eat What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Stephen Hooper.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with neuroscientist Dr. Rachel Hertz about her new book, Why You Eat What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food.
Dr. Hertz, this book, the headings and the titles of your chapters are fascinating. The Fab Four, Tasty, Eye Candy, Food is Love. I want to ask why I have to eat that Hershey bar at 3 o'clock, but my question is, given these titles, what are the sort of key factors that influence what we eat from your work and as you discuss in your book?
So really, there's kind of two major pillars of what I'm talking about. One is the sensory. So eye candy is about how vision influences our experience of what we're tasting and how we're eating it and so forth. And the other is about how our emotions and psychology and environment are impinging upon us and changing our relationship with food and our perception of food and so forth. Like, Food is Love is about, in fact, how the feeling of being in romantic love triggers the same part of the brain, the anterior cingulate, as tasting sweet does. So that when we are feeling romantic love, food tastes sweeter, and even food that doesn't have any sugar in it, like distilled water, as an example.
So when I can drink distilled water and I'm in a loving relationship or moments, that tastes better.
Exactly.
Well, it's really interesting because I want to pick up on this idea of how both the taste perception is influenced by emotions. You talk about a couple of examples of how, like, depression can make certain foods taste different and how bitterness can change a moral outlook. What are you talking about in those situations? Is that the same sort of issue?
Yeah, they're sort of related. Well, especially the one with respect to depression and taste. So what happens when we're stressed and unhappy is we have an increase in noradrenaline. And noradrenaline is a neurotransmitter which, in addition to being more rampant when we're stressed and distressed, also actually influences taste perception and increases the taste of sour. So things that are sort of tangy are going to be more sour when we are depressed. It turns out they're also going to be more bitter. And in fact, the taste of sweetness is going to be dampened. So if you're eating a sort of a lemon-lime sorbet, for example, and you're very unhappy, then that sorbet is going to taste more sour and bitter and less sweet than if you're elated, when that sorbet is going to taste sweeter and less bad in the tangy, sour way that if you don't like that aspect of it. So that's where that side is coming from. In the case of eating bitter food, this kind of goes back to what I was telling you about with respect to the connection between bitter and the emotion of disgust. And so bitter taste is a negative taste sensation, and it's related to the emotion of disgust, and our feelings of moral indignation or moral disapproval is also connected to that. And when you give somebody something bitter to taste, it makes people more morally judgmental as a function of activating the neural circuitry involved in disgust and therefore also moral condemnation.
Wow.
Related to that, I was wondering if there are other factors that influence some of the relationships that you just mentioned. So in your research, did you find if you were obese, older, younger, male, female, a different ethnicity, if you maybe had a chronic illness, anything like that that may be additionally factors that would affect some of those relationships you just described?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I looked at everything that you just mentioned except for chronic illness, other than if you consider depression a chronic illness, which it certainly can be. But I think those are excellent questions. So there are differences, for example, in smell perception and also food smell perceptions as a function of whether or not somebody is obese or not. There are differences between men and women. There are differences as a function of age. And there's sort of like these complex interactions, which I don't know if we have time to go into, but I certainly address that. And from the point of view of culture, that's also an excellent question. So the adage of one man's meat is another man's poison is absolutely true. And I talk about how culture has an enormous impact on what we perceive as, you know, good food and why that's really a learned perception and not something based inherently in what we're consuming.
You know, we're trying in medicine, I'm a family physician, and we're trying increasingly to teach our residents, to teach our learners to be more engaged, to teach our patients to really go for whole foods and the belief that rather than focusing so much on the weight, we focus on healthy eating. But you also have something in your book that talks about organic foods and that there's some caution to be made. What's the caution?
So organic food can be, you know, healthier, and certainly I am in 100% agreement that processed food and, you know, sort of picking up the already prepared meal that's frozen and so forth is not a healthy way to eat at all. And as a function of the many chemicals that are put into those products, that it can really run havoc with your metabolism and your microbiome and change all kinds of things in an unhealthy way. Now, organics is a different story, and organic is also a sort of a controversial topic. You know, is it really organic? What does organic mean? And so forth, as a function of, you know, the labeling of organic. But one of the really interesting things I found, and this is also connected to research on morality, is that when people see a lot of labels of USDA organic and honest tea and purity something or other, those words actually trigger the thoughts of moral superiority in a way that actually makes people behave less kindly towards other people immediately afterwards if they have the opportunity to be, let's say, selfish or not selfish. And there's been a variety of studies done which have shown that when people have the sense of moral superiority, rather than being kind of kinder, they're actually a little bit more selfish and potentially more likely to cheat if they have the opportunity to and behave, you know, somewhat badly towards their fellow human if they have the opportunity to. It's sort of the Whole Foods parking lot scenario, which I've heard can be terrible, people running each other over. But in any case, it's just something to be cautioned of, that these words themselves, so it's not the fact that you're eating organic carrots versus conventional carrots. That doesn't have the impact. It's these labels that say honest and pure and organic and fair trade and so forth that make people feel like they've already done something good and virtuous for humanity or for themselves as well, and then makes them sort of stingier at the next level in social interactions.
So this is not just about if I'm overweight. It's about how I approach and think about food and the marketing of the food and the all of the things that go into all the senses.
Right. And actually, I mean, the labeling of it is really the culprit. It's not, you know, like I said, the organic actual produce versus the conventional. It's the labeling of things and how we're influenced by seeing those labels and how those labels then imbue us with some kind of feeling morally or ethically as a function of that. I mean, one of the other really interesting things I found in researching this book is that when people see the label organic, they actually believe that there are fewer calories in the product than if they see just a conventional version of the same thing. So, for example, people believe that organic Oreos have fewer calories than conventional Oreos, even though there's nothing about caloric content in that label. There's just this assumption on the basis of healthier or better for you in this general way that it also somehow must be less likely to be contributing to, let's say, weight gain. And that's absolutely not true. And so it's just be one of the things that I talk about is how we need to be really careful about how labels and marketing may be steering us. And one of the things that's also really amazing is that when people believe that something is being purportedly healthy, they tend to eat more of it, even when it's the exact same product as when if it's described as being really decadent. So in fact, there's benefits to thinking that what you're consuming is really decadent and high calorie and indulgent because we tend to eat less of it, as well as the fact that our metabolism is more activated as a function of those words. And this is all irrespective of the true calorie content in what we're consuming. And that is just an amazing effect. So we have these placebo effects that can occur metabolically as a function of the labels we see on foods, as well as the fact that these labels can then somehow as well influence how we behave with other people.
This is absolutely fascinating and leads right into a question as we move to the close of our conversation. But in your research, what other thoughts or advice or guidance would you give for patient care, patient practical steps in terms of how they should choose their food, smell their food, et cetera?
Well, so these are really excellent questions. And I know that, I mean, there are various chronic diseases and, for instance, cancer being one particular scourge where eating becomes really difficult. So, in fact, getting the appropriate nutrition in can often be a challenge. And there's been some really interesting research about how color can be helpful for making people more likely to want to eat something or other colors which are more of a turn-off, and how textures can also be a factor in making food more acceptable. But basically, the bottom line, I think, is I really just want people to think for a minute about what it is that they're doing and whether or not it's healthy and how to maybe make it healthier for them, whatever that case might be for them. And armed with all the information that I provide, hopefully, in my book about how our senses and the social environment and our emotional state and so forth is influencing how we are perceiving the food and how we are experiencing the food, that the whole idea is so that I want people to get the most pleasure out of it and the most nutritional benefit out of it. And so it's just a figuring that out according to you in the best way possible moving forward.
Sounds like good guidance for all of our listeners.
We really appreciate Dr. Rachel Hertz of Brown University and Boston College being our guest today. I love the message that our patients are in charge. The book promises, and I believe it delivers truly about self-discovery, and we're heard today about psychology and neurology and physiology and the environment, very complex ways that I think brings it down for very practical things. So thank you so much for being our guest today on Your Health, Rachel.
Thank you so much, Steve and Adam. It was really great to be on.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Stephen Hooper. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Jamil and I are going to actually answer listener health questions and concerns. Any listener can send a question to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd be happy to answer it on an upcoming show. Let's ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question.
I read about the recent outbreak of chickenpox in North Carolina, and it made me pretty frustrated. Both of our children have been vaccinated, but I'm just curious, are they at any risk of disease by being around other children who are not vaccinated?
Well, I don't think they'd be at risk of chickenpox since they've been vaccinated. It's less clear to me if the frustration here is because you're worried about your children increased risk, or you're just like frustrated, like we did what we were supposed to do. We've cut down on the public health burden. You as another parent have not, and you're now subjecting others to things that they wouldn't normally get potentially.
And not only that, you know, when children get chickenpox, it's more benign, but if someone's pregnant or an adult gets chickenpox, there's a lot of morbidity and possibly mortality that can go with that.
Right. And it's not just inconvenient sometimes for children. Some of the children can get
more ill, and there's parents that have to miss time from work. It's not totally unpainful to the children and the febrile illness. I do understand that chickenpox, at least when I was growing up, before there was a vaccination, it was like, oh, this is a common childhood illness and you would want to be exposed. You'd get it so you wouldn't get to adulthood. You would hope not to get to adulthood. But now that we do have a vaccination and can really prevent it in the great majority of cases, you know, that's important. It also made me think, Jamila, about, you know, there are other diseases. We've been seeing tremendous increase in measles, which is a much more serious illness among unvaccinated. I saw a recent case of pertussis, the whooping cough in someone unvaccinated. These are things that can be life-threatening. I don't really think that we should really want to just think that this is all about choice. I think that it is about a public health approach that we need to respect.
I agree.
Yeah. I know this is an area that others feel really strongly about, and we respect different views on this, but we also know that when you're talking about children and adults that could be dying from vaccine-preventable diseases, that that perspective is important.
Exactly. And it happens in countries that don't even have access to the vaccines.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Laura, what's our very next house call?
My 34-year-old sister seems to be having some mental health issues that have resulted in a few worrying behaviors. She isn't open to talking to us about it, but we're still concerned. What can we do to force her to seek care?
Well, this is an important question and lots of different thoughts. What's one of the first things that comes to your mind, Jamila?
Is she at risk for harming herself or others?
Yeah. What type of behaviors is she doing? Is she like withdrawing? Is she getting angry? Is she crying a lot? Is she talking about how worthless she is? What are those? Or is she starting to mumble? Or starting to see things like hallucinations, like someone who is developing schizophrenia.
Right.
Lots of kind of concerns there. But, boy, you're noticing things, right? You've got a relationship with your sister that's an important relationship. And, oh, am I so glad that they have a family member that's got a relationship and that's concerned. And as a provider, nothing makes me really happier than to have a family member come in with the patient and saying, I came in today because I'm concerned.
It's helpful history, especially when the loved one maybe can't articulate what's going on.
We don't know what the diagnosis is, but there's something.
There's something going on.
There's something going on. Definitely reach out. A mental health professional, primary care physician, someone that can be helpful.
Yep.
Laura, what's our very last house call?
I think I've gotten into a bad habit. I'm only getting 5 or so hours of sleep at night during the week, and then I sleep 9 to 10 hours on the weekend in an attempt to catch up. I never feel rested. What's the best way to get on a healthier schedule?
I wonder if this patient was in that study that we talked about in the Research That Matters. They were the ones who were deprived of sleep.
Well, I know. I would definitely want to ask, is this self-induced, meaning are you doing activating, alerting activities in the evening that's preventing you from feeling that natural circadian rhythm, sleepiness that we all feel in the evening if we are shutting the lights down and doing relaxation activities, but also what are you doing in the bed? Or are you lying there feeling like anxious and can't fall asleep? And so the strategies really depend on kind of what's going on. If you're working in bed, you know, maybe we want to do some stimulus control and take work out of the bedroom.
I can't look up something on my phone late at night.
Really,
12 o'clock.
Not healthy. Light from the phone is alerting and will activate wake chemistry in the brain, making it hard to fall back to sleep.
Yeah, you know, I have been struck most recently by thinking about ways of helping us embrace sleep. One of the ways I've found helpful is to say, I'm looking forward to sleep because I will wake up more refreshed. And the prayers, and in my particular faith, a Jewish prayer is something called the bedtime Shema. It's a prayer that recognizes the potentiality of waking up rejuvenated. And it says, in the name of my Lord, may an angel be on my right, may an angel be on my left, may an angel be in front of me, and may an angel be behind me, and may above me be a holy presence of something greater than myself. When I say that at night, sometimes that really does help. Doesn't hurt.
It doesn't hurt. And you want to ritualize sleep and have really proper hygiene around it so that we can take advantage of what sleep gifts to us.
I love it. I love the gift. Thank you. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank all our listeners for joining us on Your Health. If you have a question or a story, you can send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'll talk about it on an upcoming show. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. Our great guest today, Dr. Rachel Hertz. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Jamila Battle.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.